Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the table?
Hey, Brian.
Shenouk?
What are you doing here?
What's the talk of the table?
No, wait.
This week, we are sitting down with Bridget Jeffries. Bridget is the community coordinator at Chaosium, the publisher of Call of Cthulhu, and part of their community ambassador team. Bridget founded a horror gaming club, Symphony Entertainment Gaming and Arts, which solely focuses on horror-based systems. And she is also a member of the Miskatonic University podcast. Bridget, welcome to the show.
Welcome.
Hey, thank you guys so much for having me. I've been looking forward to this all week.
Us too. We've been looking forward to it since Breakout Con.
Yes. Thank you guys sincerely for having me on. I appreciate it. And I'm already completely in love with the energy at the table.
Oh, we love it.
And who's that? And who's
okay,
that?
Now I'm concerned.
Oh, no.
I was also part of the game. It was me. I'm special. I too am special. Say I'm special, Brian.
Shenouk, we haven't actually introduced the game yet.
Oh, my bad.
No.
Joining us at the table is Shenouk DeSera.
It's me.
Yay!
And the reason that Bridget, that we wanted you on was because Elliot, Shenouk, and I were at Breakout Con up in Toronto.
Yeah.
And you ran a Call of Cthulhu game, which Shenouk was a part of, like a live actual play. And we went excited to like support our friend. And like have a good time and like watch a good show. And we left being like, that GM was fucking awesome. Shenouk, you were very good too.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, you're all right.
You're all right. The shade. Oh, God, it's delicious.
But leaving that game, Elliot, Shenouk and I were going back and forth of the things that we noticed that we had not seen before and not seen done well that you were doing particularly well or differently. And we were like, oh, we got to have this person on. And it was so much so that like some of the things you did in that show, I was then using in the games that I ran the next day.
Holy hell, Brian, compliment of the day. Wow. Thank you.
Hey, it's not a compliment. It's just the truth. So I think we're going to get into the things that we kind of call that we noticed throughout this interview, the things that we noticed that we think you did really well, that we want to learn from. But I think to start us off, I'd love to ask you and get your thoughts on how do you approach a live in-person event differently than something that is either over stream or is pre-recorded or is just a home game?
Ooh, you came out swinging? Really? That's how you feel? That's the first question?
First question.
Just a nice light toss for the first one.
Right. That's the light toss? Lord, how long is this interview again?
Just a quick 4 hours.
Yeah. Just a quick
real
four
quick.
Hours. Just
it'll fly by. Session.
You'll be fine. So I think your environment dictates a lot of your storytelling. Because no environment is the same, and your end goal for each environment that you're, you know, participating in from a storytelling standpoint is completely different. If I'm running a game for the four of you gorgeous individuals, you know, that environment changes. Am I running it at my home where I have complete privacy and I know what I can work with? Am I running it at a convention where if I'm dealing with like really intense horror subjects, the 11-year-old at the table next to me might overhear? Am I running a situation where we're playing a certain type of horror? So I think your environment really dictates the type of story that you're going to tell, because I'm going to run a game differently if you guys are in my basement than I'm going to do for a live show in front of, you know, I don't know, 1,000 people or 100 people or 8 people. And that's also going to be different than what I get in convention play. So it varies based on the type of story that you're telling and your end goal that you're trying to get out of the storytelling. Like at Breakout Con, we were there to entertain an audience. So my focus needed to be on entertaining the audience, because you guys either paid for tickets to be at that event or you took time away from your convention experience, which costs money, and other resources to be there. So my objective was to entertain the audience. So I had to approach that a lot differently than I would do if I was entertaining, I don't know, a podcast audience or, you know, people at the crib.
And I imagine like in your position, you run a lot of in-person games in a year, but I guess just to kind of table set, how many sort of events like this are you doing in a year?
Ooh, babe, like actual live shows, I'd probably put it at maybe about a dozen a year. And then I do a massive megaton of podcasting and streaming to kind of bridge the gap in between. Where I rarely get to play is just like at home with my friends. Like post-COVID. It's like, is that a thing? Do people actually get together and hang out like just with their normal? Or nope. We're all international. We're all across the globe. We all get on Zoom. Got it.
That's our biggest thing. I haven't, until recently, I hadn't had like a home game in like 2 years.
Yeah,
just,
right?
Just a lot amazing. Of podcast games.
Never mind an in-person home game, which is just adds a whole other layer of coordination.
Oh my God, an in-person home game where like schedules coordinate and people actually show up at the same location at the same time? Whoa.
Unheard of.
Yeah.
Mythic.
Unheard of.
Truly unheard of.
And then, like, what's the kind of range of scale you're dealing with at these events? And within that, is there, like, a size crowd that you have preference for?
Ooh. Is there a size crowd that I have a preference for? All right, babe. So, like, real talk, part of me wants to be, like, the more the better. Like, if I can pack out an auditorium of 20,000 people, let's also do that. But I did that once at PAX Australia. I wasn't running, but I was a player on the stage. And by the time you got done with the lights and the sound equipment and who can hear what, you're listening to the tech crew move around in the background and you look out into blinding light, but you can see all these people. Yeah, your nervous system tends to do some really comedic things at that point. I would say my happy space. I don't know, babe. Give me 100 to 200 and I think I'll be a happy girl. But let's not wag a finger at the intimacy of what you get in those. How many were people were in that room with us? 8, 9?
Maybe like 10 max.
Wasn't many. Yeah, maybe in the like 10 or 12.
Maybe 10. Like those 10 people contributed so much and they were seen in so many different ways during, you know, the storytelling aspect. Those intimate rooms can give you a lot of bang for your buck because it's much easier to engage with the crowd and it's much easier to get everyone in on the collaborative storytelling. So I'm just going to walk back my previous answer and be like, I don't know. It depends on the day, I guess.
And that is one of the things that we particularly noticed that you did really well, because crowd participation in any live event is so hit or miss. is so wildly hit or miss.
Your mileage will vary.
Absolutely. But I think the way you approached the crowd was so much as a collaborator. And like with so much respect to the audience that like they will be heard and they will be respected in that. And because of that, the audience only gave you good stuff. Like there weren't any like bits. There wasn't any distracting stuff. Mm-hmm. It was everyone's only throwing out their best ideas. And then it was also really great that you pitched it to the crowd, pitched like, you know, what is the setting or something?
Yeah.
10 people would give answers. And then you could kind of just have this great pool of things to choose from.
Yeah.
And then everyone got heard, but you also got to pick the one that you liked.
Right.
It's a great way to not like make anybody who threw out an idea feel bad for throwing out an idea when it's
facts.
Like when you keep and I did remember thinking this, like when you ask for more options, you're not telling the person who's already given an options that their option's bad. You're just like, no, I want like a big tapestry of options, even if maybe your internal thought is like, well, that's not quite there. Like, what else can we get from the crowd? But you never played it like that. And I thought like everybody always felt like Brian said, heard.
Holy hell, Elliot, thank you for that. Genuinely, thank you for that.
And then I think kind of bouncing off of the crowd, the interaction with the crowd was also the seamless nature of live shows are tough because you have to build characters, build world, build story, and end it all in like 2 hours.
Yeah. Right.
That is hard.
Go, baby,
coming
go.
Coming from a podcaster who often goes plans for 4 episodes but goes for 6.
Well.
It's very difficult. But there was a seamless nature to, okay, we're starting. We're going to introduce these people. We're going to start building these characters, weaving in then what the players wanted, what you as a GM wanted, what the audience was asking for. And then as that character creation started getting towards the end of it, not at the end, but towards the end, you started going around and dropping just crazy truth bombs on people of like, okay, great. You guys have all decided on the world. Now let me tell you a thing about the world that exists and like recontextualize everything.
Yeah.
I'm curious for Shenouk maybe how versus what I know we do on the podcast, which is most of your character creation and play experience, like what that experience was like from like this seamless transition of character creation into play.
Ooh.
Yeah. No, I was like, what the fuck? How did she do that? I mean, I didn't see it coming. I was like, oh, cool. We're just like building our characters and like we'll establish the world. And like all of a sudden, oh no, like we're already on the bus. Like Bridget put us there immediately. I'm thinking now like, oh fuck, where's my character going to be now? And like panicking as like she's coming down the table. Cause like did not like, such a good way, at least for a horror game, to like set, like already induce like panic and like stress onto a player in a game that is supposed to be doing that to me. Yeah, it fully, like, it felt seamless. Like, oh, like I'm here, and like I knew my character so well already. Just
and like I didn't even character so well too. Oh,
and I,
baby.
And I didn't even like have to like think about it. Like I was just put in such a good position as a player to like not even know that, oh, I know everything I need to know already, and like, yeah, of course we're coming here. But like I'm the dumb player that's like, oh shit. So it's just like really good GMing to set up the players in a way that was like, oh fuck, I already know what I'm doing.
Holy hell, baby. Thank you for that. I appreciate that. It's I'll say one thing that's tying the thread between the four of us together is set people up for success on the front end.
Yeah.
Do what you can to set people up for success on the front end. So one of the things that I do with my streaming channel on Symphony, like, you know, when you're in the pre-show and you're like, all right, we're going to go live in 30 minutes. Let's go through etiquette and blah, 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 blah. One of the things I always, always articulate at the end of like, hey, don't turn your cameras off, or hey, if your dog comes into the room, send thoughts and prayers, is like, hey, all the players, we are gathered here today to make this keeper, this GM, this storyteller, whoever is in the driving seat, look good. If we all focus on making that person look good, if they can trust us that we won't abandon their story, we won't disrupt their story, that we're in the game with them, then they will look good. The story will look good. The product will look good. The publisher will look good. The platform will look good. And then respectively, all of us as players will look good along with our little marching order of things too. So one of the things I did when we arrived on site with all of the players, I told them, I was like, hey guys, we can tell any type of story that you want to tell. It's fully improvised. I'm going to be pulling ideas from you. I'm going to be pulling ideas from the audience. My preferred GMing style is emotional horror. I want to make it hurt. I want to get it under your fingernails. I want to make it uncomfortable. I love high impact emotional horror. That's my preference. If we can go that direction, great. If we can't, all right, we'll send thoughts and prayers. I'll navigate as necessary. And then coming into the room, the players were already on Team Bridget, which means I was on Team Players, which means we set the tone of that room immediately once the game began. And that just helps, like, set people up for success on the front end. A little bit of intentionality on the front end can save you so much heartache on the back end.
I feel like the intentionality is the word we use on this podcast a lot, whether for players, for GMs, mm-hmm. or for, like, game designers. Just
yes.
because just knowing what you're shooting for means you can get closer to it.
Like, oh, say it again for the people in the back. Yes,
knowing
Lord.
What you're shooting for can uh-huh. get you closer.
Uh-huh. This is the way. Yes. Put it on a t-shirt, damn it.
Buy that t-shirt.
So Bridget, there's something in there you said, which you said emotional horror is your preferred GM style. And
yeah.
But I think there's probably more to your preferred GM style than those two words, and like kind of outside of genre. I'm curious if what we saw you do on stage is like your preferred GM style, or how you would define your preferred GM style from a genre perspective, from a preparatory perspective, from an improvisation perspective. Like, how do you kind of define that style?
Was that another softball question? Is that what's going on?
Soft. I'm lobbing these light pitches to you.
Right. We got the tough ones coming in the second half.
Oh, is that what it is? Got it. How long is this recording again? Okay, so one, that was a beautifully articulated question, and I can jump in on that one with total comfort. Where I am right now in my evolution of storytelling, because let's admit, none of us are the same storytellers today that we were yesterday or 10 years ago or will be in 10 years. Elliot, where Bridget is today... All right, let me keep this shit super real. I hate reading modules. I do. I'll write them. I hate reading them. I hate reading modules. I hate reading pre-done adventures. And anytime I have to run one, I'm like, but I don't want to. It's so good to see your face again. Elliot, part of that frustration comes from the point that where I am right now in my evolution of storytelling is I am improv focused. That's just where I want to be. So I want the minimum amount that I need from text to run a game. So like right now, I pull a lot of content from the Miskatonic repository. That is Chaosium's community content platform where you can go on and publish your own shit. There are 13,000 word scenarios that are like platinum bestsellers, and I will probably never read them. But that one guy who's putting out the pamphlets that's 500 words that says, this is your intro, here's maybe one NPC, here's your climax, and have a good day, I can run with that all day because that's my preferred storytelling style. So really what you guys saw was me cultivating an environment that I already knew that I would flourish in. I could have run the haunting. I could have run a pre-done module and said, all right, if you enjoyed that scenario, make sure you go to chaosium.com and pick up blah, blah, blah. Nah, I catered to what I knew I was comfortable with and what I would thrive in the most, which is fully improvised games. So what I did is basically I cheated the system and I set myself up for success. I put myself in an arena that I knew I would do well in because it's my preferred arena. I love low prep, high improv games. And they allow me to be lazy as shit, babe. Y'all see how much shit y'all came up with? That story was the bomb because of staff and because of the volunteers and because of the players and because of you guys in the audience and the cast. I just tied seams together. That's delicious for me. That's my happy place.
I do really want to just highlight a thing you said there, because I think we say a lot, set yourself up for success. But I think you saying cultivate an environment in which you know you'll flourish is the more poetic way to say it. But also, like, kind of kick something. It's so much more specific of, like, if you know you're good at this thing, lean into that thing.
Babe, go do that damn thing. Yeah, that's what you're good at. Like, okay, so Chinook, you do stand-up comedy, right?
Yeah.
I'm sure there are various types of comedy that you could approach, but you know what you're best at. What are you best at on the stage? Where do you flourish from a comedy performance standpoint?
My happy place is doing biographical material. Stuff about me, it's the easiest stuff to do.
So why would I have you up there doing impersonations? Why would you set yourself up for impersonations if you know where you flourish is over here?
Yeah.
It's the same mindset. Do what you know you do best and be intentional about, again, cultivating that type of environment.
But actually, Shannon's got a great Arnold Schwarzenegger. Can you give us a little sample real quick?
No. Get the fuck out of here, you piece of shit.
Oh, that's great.
Goddamn monster.
You goddamn monster.
You monster.
What a fucked up joke.
That's so good. Throwing an impression on someone in the moment, very good. Very, very good.
And then I guess kind of continuing on this kind of your GM style, I know I can trace my, you know, GM lineage back through, like, the various actual plays that I've liked and loved and listened to. I'm curious, are there any touchstone other GMs for you, either it just in home games or in actual plays, that you recognize, like, oh, this part of what I do comes from this person. Oh, this part of what I do comes from this person.
Oh, you're giving me an opportunity to celebrate someone else. This is awesome. My happy place. Yes. Babe, without a shadow of a doubt, have any of you guys had the opportunity to experience, I will articulate it that way, Graham Walmsley?
I've not.
Oh, okay. So that is going to be a treat that I will assign you guys as homework for at some point in 2024.
Okay.
Listen or watch anything that, that Graham Walmsley does as a GM. So just a couple high points for his storytelling style. One, he's an award-winning game designer. He's the one that created Cthulhu Dark. And then he also, wrote Stealing Cthulhu and a few other things. It's Graham Walmsley. He is European. He has a very nice, beautiful, soft-spoken voice that kind of hovers around here, and it never really gets above this volume, but it's very sympathetic, and it's very empathetic, and it's very casual, and it's very welcoming, and it's very inviting, and he just has this sweet, adoring, mellow, optimistic personality, which contrasts so beautifully when he starts fucking you over in a horror environment. Because you're sitting here getting swooned out by this gorgeous voice, and he's just really just patient, I love you eyes. But the horror hits so much harder because it's in massive contrast to who he is as a person. That was very inspiring to me, because you guys can tell from this podcast and you saw me in person, I'm very hyper, I'm very loud, I'm very bubbly, I'm very flirtatious, and I'm all over the fucking place. That contrasts well when I slow my speech down, or when I start making direct eye contact with people, or when I start moving with them, or when I start glaring at people, because it's such a contrast to what you get on a regulated basis. So it's kind of like you get that system shock and then that recovery in the storytelling. The other thing Graham does beautifully that I am attempting to steal, duplicate, imitate as much as I can, because again, we evolve as storytellers. He is so supportive of the people at his table. He celebrates good ideas. He yes ands absolutely beautifully. And he, if you get a chance, he does this damn thing where if something really horrific happens, he just stops all the action. He pauses and he goes, wow, that's just really beautiful. And you're sitting there like, but Graham is not really beautiful. Like, Chinook just admitted that he killed his baby brother. That's nothing beautiful about that. But that's what he stops and he just goes, Wow, that's really encouraging when you're a horror player to know that you're doing something horrific in the game. Graham Walmsley, that's who I want to be as a storyteller in this current era of my life.
Love that.
And I'm going to send this podcast to him and make him listen to all these compliments so he can sit in his discomfort. Bam, Graham, eat it.
You are loved.
You are loved, Graham. People want to tell stories like you do, Graham.
We got you. We got you, motherfucker, with love.
Sit in your discomfort and let's go.
Can I
throw out a random compliment while I'm there?
Yeah, sure.
Absolutely. Chinook, holy shit. That reveal, by the way, at the end of the game where you was like, the voice he was calling out to was like, you know, his mom or was me because I killed my brother. Babe, I remember hugging the wall going, oh, retroactively, that makes everything that this character said leading up to this moment so much more heartbreaking. It's so my... And you did this thing that was just beautiful from a performance standpoint. You got really quiet, you pulled your shoulders in, and you hunched down towards the table to the point that I and the rest of the audience had to lean in just to experience whatever confession you were going for. Way to embody that character in that moment. I remember the space and time where I was hugging that wall when I was like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. Brilliantly done.
Mm. That's so nice, Bridget. Thank you.
Now you can sit in your discomfort of compliments.
Yeah, we love you. Yeah.
We love you.
We love you.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love me too.
Rom-Com Drama Bomb is a three-player, GM-less, asymmetrical TTRPG about meet-cutes and mayhem. In this 90-minute timed game, you'll play as two people who shouldn't fall in love and the evil villain who will stop at nothing to make sure they do. Rom-Com Drama Bomb is now available. You can grab it digitally at moreblueberries.itch.io/romcom, or you can grab a physical book, the pinkest book you've ever seen, at moreblueberries.shop/romcom. Check it out and happy rom-comming. Rom-comming? I don't know. Drama bombing?
Speak into the void. You never know who may be listening. In the Annie Award-winning Void 1680 AM, you take on the role of a late-night radio DJ. Use a standard poker deck and a six-sided die to build your playlist, interact with callers, and assemble a show that expresses something about why you love the music that you do. Void 1680 AM includes rules for single session and ongoing play, so you can develop the relationships of your DJ with your callers over time. You can even join the growing community of affiliate DJs whose shows are broadcast live on air and on YouTube. Shop Void 1680 AM now at bannerless.games/shop and take 20% off your order with promo code DUNGEON. Again, that's 20% off your order with promo code DUNGEON.
I love that you brought up contrast, Bridget, because in talking about Graham and like what you learned from him with this like soft voice and big horror, because I think this is one of the other things we noticed in watching you is that you were able to maintain this lighthearted, even at times jokey tone that then with contrast made the horror moments hit like a fucking ton of bricks.
Thank you.
And I guess like the question I have there is just like that like how are you thinking about that balance when you're up there of just like I want this to be fun so that I can punch him
with that. <Yeah. laughs>
Elliot, I feel like you see me. I feel like you get me.
I do.
So real talk, it's a 2-hour game. You can't spend 40 minutes on build-up and setup. What I will spend time in on character development, because that matters. Who these people embody as characters matters for the rest of the story. So the second the game started, I put a timer on my phone, so I knew when I was an hour out and when I was 30 minutes out from the completion, so I knew how to pace myself accordingly. Because this is a 2-hour game. It's very easy to get lost. It's very easy to pigeonhole. It's very easy to chase a red hair. It's very easy to do a lot of dumb shit. But 2 hours, you need to hit them, and you need to hit them hard. So kind of to answer your question, Elliot, with pacing, how that applies to tension, you only have 2 hours. The human body can only navigate so much in a tense fight or flight state. You can only embody that type of tension for so long before you have to alleviate it with something. And the typical way to alleviate it is with humor. Either crack a joke or allow your nervous system to calm down, allow yourself to breathe. That's how you can keep the story moving. That's how you can make the horror hits drop harder. That's how you can keep that momentum going, because you can't, I mean, you guys have been through, I'm sure you guys have been through experiences where someone either tried to make you laugh for 2 hours straight or keep you scared for 2 hours straight. It's not sustainable. There's nothing sustainable about it. You have to let the human body alleviate stress where they can. Where I got super fortunate is I had a table that would alleviate and immediately jump back into the moment and not alleviate and distract and go down the street. It was very easy for everybody to come back together. So a lot of that balance is reading the temperature of the room and the story and knowing when you need a break, or allowing your players to take it. Like Chinooks, we were doing all these, oh, I'm brooding in the front of the bus. Oh, I'm on the back of the bus. Oh, I've been here and I've got this suit. And then Chinook is like, I jump onto the back of the bus and I'm riding on it. Brilliant. Absolutely. That was just great placement on you, babe, because you were the last player to go and everyone brought so much trauma and baggage and drama, especially as I was like weaving in people's backstories retroactively. It was nice to get that. There's a character hanging on the back of the bus right now.
I saw a now I forget who to attribute this to, but someone said a great line that I really like, that is, if you don't break, the audience will for you. Oh. And their timing is not as good as yours.
I know M. Friedman said that to us at some point. I don't know if that's an original M. Friedman, but I know M. Friedman has said that before.
Okay, so yeah. Okay, so Dr. M. Friedman.
Oh, that's so good.
But yeah, if you try to maintain that tension, I think this is what happens when, like, in horror movies that are horror for too long, like, yep. Why sometimes the audience laughs at times when it's not funny.
Mm-hmm.
Because you have to. You can't sit there for 2 hours with your butthole clenched. Yeah.
Like, no, you can't. It's not sustainable. It's not sustainable. And that shit is not enjoyable. Who wants to do 2 hours of butt clenching? Like, come on now.
Exactly.
Well, listen, well, I'm not kink shaming. You go live the truth. I support you in how you want to do it. Have a good time, guys.
I'll say, like, what I also enjoyed a lot about playing with you is, like for players that make those ridiculous, like, I made a bunch of ridiculous, dumb choices, as I do. And I love a GM that will absolutely hold me to it and punish me for it. Like, I got absolutely fucked up.
Oh, right.
Because I deserved it. Like, I fully deserved it. I think that was, like, satisfying for me as a player and, like, for the audience of, like, yeah, why the fuck is this guy acting so, like, nonchalant about the situation? Like, he needs to suffer consequences, and like, you absolutely delivered those consequences. And I was like, oh, I deserve this. I'm an idiot.
But that was a great dance between us, right? It was your fuck around and me going find out.
Yeah,
but we balanced that together. Like, we told that story together. I was like, oh, you want to fuck around? Then let's find out. But one thing, guys, that's so fucking important to me in all storytelling, I literally have it embedded into the stupid little tagline on my symphony company, is player agency. If the decisions you make in-game don't matter, why the fuck are we sitting here today? If you do some dumb shit to the monster and I go, well, the plot says, or this book says, or the story says, and I don't respond to you, why did you show up today? Why are we here? Make people see and feel seen in the moment and make their choices matter. Even if they're negative consequences. You know what? That builds good story. You'll be all right. Frustration tolerance is good for everybody.
I think this actually cues us up well for one of the things that most impacted me of, like, the performance and of your style. And it's the thing that I directly took the next day.
Oh, I'm excited to hear this.
And it was, this is one of those moments where, like, when you see someone who is really good at something do something simple, you recognize that, like, oh, that simplicity, like, to make it look so simple took a lot of time. And it was, you were walking in front of the table and you were, you know, very kinetic and, like, narrating things for all the players. And then at some point, someone would make a roll or they would say something. You'd walk over to them, you would tap the table in front of them, and you'd say, you take the narrative. And I was like, that is a revelation to me of how simple that is and how direct it is. It is a kindness to the player. And I love anything that is that simple, that directs who is in focus.
Mm-hmm.
And with three words, you told the audience, you told the players, you told yourself whose turn it is to talk.
Yeah.
And it was so fucking good.
Yes! Okay, so one, thank you. Two, heard, three, thank you. Four, how did that play out at your table? Can you give us like a quick, like, what did that look like when you implemented it? How did it feel? How did it get responded to?
It felt really good because it's kind of a thing that I do already, but mm-hmm. but not as clean. It's like, okay, tell okay. me. It was kind of more of a suggestion when I often did it. It's like, okay, tell me what that looks like. Tell me how that feels. And I think those are good. But turning to a player, especially who, you know, none of us know each other at a table. We were playing Orbital Blues.
Okay.
So, you know, sad space cowboys. They'd make a roll and I'd tap the table and go, you take the narrative. What happens next?
Yeah.
And you see the player realize what the mission is. All uh-huh. the other players also realize, like, okay, this is now kind of for the minute, this is the new GM.
Yep.
They're the one
yes,
taking control.
Right, come through. Yes.
Whatever they pick, I now have to support. And the whole table got, it's one of those things, you don't have to explain it. It just mm-hmm. explains itself. And mm-hmm. that's why it's so good.
Oh God, like my toes are curling. I'm so glad that worked out well for you and your table, babe. Bravo. Way to evolve.
Oh, I'm going to be using it all the time.
Way to evolve. I appreciate that.
It's so good.
There's something else in there that I loved about the way you GM'd and like, and this kind of relates to embodying the story, embodying the host of that event versus embodying like NPCs. And it was like there was a lot of physicality choices in how you ran that game that really struck me. Like within this thing Brian's talking about of Take the Narrative is the light tap on the table. And then like at times there were like hard taps on the table for like a quick bite that like an NPC is delivering. And then I remember in particular there was one moment where you fully turned your back on the audience to talk directly to I think Omega Jones as an NPC. And it was like, that's bad. That's really bad news. Like as an audience member, you're just like that Cthulhu Mythos character doesn't care that I'm here. And that feels bad. And I'm curious if you do that in all kinds of games or if this is unique to live shows, the physicality of your GMing.
Ellie, that is 100% committed to live shows.
Mm.
100%. Because I'm so high energy and because I'm so damn hyper, I tend to stand when I GM either at home or at games, but I don't go through a lot of the kinetics or the physicality. Blah, 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 that's fun. Unless I'm doing a live show, because at that point, I'm not just helping to tell a story, I'm entertaining a crowd. And I can't really embody that well over a podcast. Like, prime example right now, I heard that this was audio only, so, like, I'm in pajamas with no bra and hanging out. I don't really care what you guys see off of my face, my body language. And it's a challenge to get a lot of that off, even if you're live streaming, because you're still restrictive to what the camera angle can offer you. But in live shows, when my goal is to entertain or involve the audience or like, you know, sew them in, embed them in, I typically go 120% on the physical actions. It was, guys, I was in an improv class at some point and one of the coaches made the statement to me, like, if you are performing on stage and then I know some of you guys have professional backgrounds, so you'll probably know better than what I'm trying to articulate right now. You have to over enunciate. You have to make the emoting 20 times bigger because, you know, people need to be able to see it or express it or immediately connect with it. It can't be as subtle as it is, like if you're just in normal conversations. So I kind of start doing, I kick everything up by 20, 30, 40, 50% if I'm live performing.
The thing that I always told people when they're in front of a camera, it's like, the camera doesn't add 10 pounds. That's not the truth. The thing is, it cuts your energy in half. So whatever you think you're giving, you got to give double it to look anything like what you think you're actually looking like.
Yeah. And a mic's almost worse. It's almost 60 or 70%.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah.
You got to add that extra oomph, at least for me. I add that extra oomph when I'm doing live shows.
It was like a connection point that I think was compelling to me as an audience member where it was like, cast was up here on stage, I'm down here in the audience. Not that this was a big room, but then you're the literal connective tissue moving back and forth across.
Yeah. Moving story, ideas, emotions, back and forth. Yeah.
There was also a fun thing that this is definitely only for live shows, but because you were moving around the table, there would often be a time where like someone on stage left was kind of having a scene and you had moved over to stage right and were whispering with someone else. So then I, as an audience member, am watching the scene that's on stage left. All of a sudden, I notice something's going on stage right. And I'm kind of like, what's happening over there? And then the person who's speaking stage left all of a sudden notices something's happening stage right. And then you commented on it like, no, no, you don't have to worry about what's going on down here. And it's like, all of a sudden, you know, because it, ultimately I'm sitting in the audience looking at a table of people lined up.
Yeah.
That is a pretty stagnant view. Yeah. All of a sudden now there's 2 to 3 different stories both in and out of the game that are happening that I'm bouncing. It's like, you know, meanwhile back at the ranch, you're cutting back and forth between two scenes.
Another compliment to Chinook during that thing, that experience that you're teeing up, rather, Brian, is the amount of times he would be on the opposite end of the table. Like, do I hear that? Am I experiencing that?
So
I'm going to go.
It's like, oh, yeah.
He was so absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, Chinook, what did it feel like to have? Because I remember that moment where I believe, Bridget, you were talking to Big Bearded Nerd.
Oh,
what was his name?
Dwight.
You were at the end of the table. Yeah. And I think you were having a scene on the other side, Chinook. Like, how did that moment feel for you as a player where there was like all of a sudden a conversation's happening and then you try to listen and it's like,
no. This isn't you.
I mean, I think it like, for like, I feel like in those moments, part of it, well, there's a lot, I think there was like a lot happening in my own brain in those moments. Such like, I want to like jump in and like be like, oh, it's like a crazy chaotic scene, but also like trying to respect like, but like, I don't know like what like Dwight's like goals and like things as a character might be. So part of it is like asking, I was honestly just asking for permission to if I could be in the scene. It kind of turned into a fun joke. And then like realizing, oh, this is like now a bit we can all do together. And like other players even use the, do I hear that thing? Like at times against me. And it was like, a very fun, just like almost innocuous, like silly moment of like, oh, like I just want to know how our like what our characters would do together, like if like we feel that connection or like if I'm like antagonistic to this group. And I think it ended up me being more antagonistic to the entire group, but just like me trying to like just get like grab more information and seeing what my character would do and how people would react to it.
Yeah,
is kind of how it felt on my end.
I love that you were a journalist that wasn't like the good guy in this story. Like, I feel like that's kind of like a natural instinct in a like Cthulhu story is like, I'm the journalist and I'm going to figure out what's going on here. But you're just like, no, I am a bad guy who will do anything
bad
for a story.
Bad things. Yeah.
I'm not a good person. And that felt right. That felt right.
You did it exceptionally well because antagonistic can be very difficult to do tastefully. And you did it well without being disruptive or distracting or spotlight hogging. Like, yes, you were successfully antagonistic, which added all of this beautiful conflict into the storytelling, which gave me so much ammunition to use, especially when you started like puffing your chest up at the mythos. But it wasn't just like you read the temperature of the room and the table and it felt natural. So, I mean, bravo to you for that, because everyone knows there are people out there that just can't play evil characters well. And not that your character was evil. I mean, your character was evil, but not that your character was like, you know, like evil, but like you did antagonistic well. Quick question for you here, Chinook, just out of curiosity. Do you think that table would have played better if we were sitting in two tables with you guys facing each other versus being in a straight line?
I think you'd such a good, like, you created such a good dynamic stage picture by like you moving around and like being like a wall, because like there was no natural stage, so like you were almost like that line between the audience and the cast. There were moments, I think one moment that really, well, moments that fucked me up as like odd as a player and like loved watching as an audience member, was when like, because you had such this big like joy, like jovial energy, and then like in these hard moments you would turn your back to the crowd and then squat in front of the player and like talk to them. And like you'd be at eye level at that point. And that scared the fuck out of me. I was like, please.
This is so
intimate. Was watching it happen to Dwight, and I can see the panic in his eyes and like him stumbling. And I was like, that's horrifying. Like as a player watching someone, not only players go through, I'm like, I don't want that. Like I will probably make a choice that makes that happen to me.
Yeah.
But watching him go through that made me sweat. So yeah, is I think looking at each other may have like taken away some of those really fun moments, especially like the way you ran that, because you might lose like the physicality of your own performance with a different stage picture. And so I, for that game in particular, I don't know if it would have actually been better as an experience if we were all facing each other. Because like I did feel a lot of things that Dwight was going through, even though I wasn't looking at him. And that's a lot because of what you were doing.
Wow, holy shit. Great perspective on that one. And heard and noted. Okay. All right. So there are benefits to having, you know, at that linear table. Okay. Good to know. Thank you for that.
I think there is also something to be said of when, like, Shinnok, when you were on one side listening to something on the other, as an audience member watching someone who is performing have to lean in and, like, look over to listen is also kind of fun to watch. Where it's like, it is a little inconvenient or like difficult for them to hear. So it's like, oh, what are they able to hear? Am I able to, like, there's a fun joining of those two perspectives there.
And the like physicality of having to talk to people from different rows of a bus feels similar. Like, you know, like if you're like True. On a bus and like you're having to turn around on a seat to talk to somebody else. Yeah. I think it worked great.
Beautiful. Thanks for the feedback, guys. I appreciate that.
You just did a good job.
Yeah, I love your face, too. We did a great job.
Kind of like thinking about this in terms of your work more as zooming out a little bit from the GM perspective and looking at the community coordinator perspective. What is a successful live event look like for you?
Oh,
another soft lob.
I know. I hate you. We just had that moment of affection. You come in here with that bullshit. What does a successful live event look like for me? Oh, this is going to be such a campy, fluffy answer, but I have to kind of be. It. Thank you for the front forward support there. Babe, did the story go off well? Did the cast have fun? Did the audience have fun? And I really think it's kind of like a hard stop from there. I can pull and embellish that out. But if I'm running a live show, the entertainment is honestly the audience. It's there to make sure that they had a good time. Did they walk away and go, wow, that was fun? Okay, that was worth 2 hours of their time that they sacrificed to spend time with us. That was successful. If cast or the table didn't have fun, I, as the storyteller, GM keeper, I, as kind of like the lead, and we as a table did something wrong. Something fell short for all of us not to have a good time. Something went wrong, and that's worth spending an intentional moment to back into it and be like, what went wrong and how can we not do that in the future? And then making sure the storyteller had a good time would be my metrics for a successful live event, even from a professional capacity. Because at the end of the day, if you're doing it from a professional capacity, you're either doing it because someone is paying you to do it, or you're trying to promote a brand or a type of storytelling. You're trying to promote something typically when you're in a live show. So you want to hit those bells successfully. And I think those bells ring louder when everyone was safe and had a good time.
And I think, I mean, there's going to be a small portion of this audience, of our listeners, who may want to try running like an in-person event for mm-hmm. an actual play.
Mm-hmm.
For someone who is thinking about doing that, or maybe already does it, what do you think are the biggest tips you could give, rather than like while you're playing, but like before the event? Like, what is the best bit of pre-production advice for a live event that you think you could give someone who's interested in running something?
Oh, okay. So one, look into the mirror ahead of time and ask yourself what you're good at. And then go do a fuck ton of that. I'm not being funny. I'm dead serious. If biographical comedy is what you're strong at, go lead out with that. If improv is your strong point, go lead out with that. If you're one of those people that spends 8 months doing prep for a 2-hour scenario, but that's what makes you feel empowered and that's where your strong suit is, go do that shit. Look yourself in the mirror and have an honest conversation of what you excel at and then double down on that. No one can tell a story the way that you do. No one can deliver a story the way that you do. So don't worry about trying to be somebody else. It is completely okay to take, you know, inspiration and coaching and advice from, you know, your personal Graham Walmsleys. Yes, that is great. There are people who are better at you in everything that you will ever do in life. And it is great to take off of their plate. But let that inspire you. Don't try to imitate it. This is going to sound cold, but this is just my transparency. When you are performing, an audience can tell when you're authentic and when you're not. Authenticity sells. If I'm not a happy-go-lucky, flirty, bubbly person and I was trying to imitate it right now, the listeners would be able to tell. So be who you are. Tell the stories that you want to tell, but make sure you're aware of what type of stories those are going to be. Other hot sheet, manage your pacing as well as you can. Shit is going to go wrong.
technology is going to fail. Tickets at the door might be late coming in. Interruptions are going to happen. You might have someone in the audience. You might have somebody on the stage that derails you. If you know you have a 2-hour game, prepare for a 1-hour game and then flush out the rest as you go.
That's a great little tidbit.
Right. Because shit is absolutely positively going to happen. And the other thing that I have found that helps me, I have control issues in real life. That's just one of my character flaws. I'm working through it in therapy and with myself and everything else. But I have massive control issues that if I allow them to take precedence and stay in the driver's seat, they will constrict the shit out of me where I actually don't get anything done because I'm too over-paralyzed with either perfection or making sure that a mistake doesn't happen. For me, in my experience when running live shows, I get a sense of almost relief because I know I can walk into those situations and surrender. I can let go. It doesn't have to be perfect. I can embody things that are happening around me. I can brace myself for things that are happening around me. I can yes and the audience. I can yes and the cast. I can yes and my damn self. I can actually come into that space and just go, I can just be here and be in the moment and I can be present. I don't have to fucking control every eventuality because one, that's not possible. And two, if you're wired like I am, it'll drive you up a wall. That would 100% be my advice.
That's all great.
Bridget, working our way to a close here.
Yeah.
One of the things we really wanted to kind of dig in a little bit with you is why horror and why Call of Cthulhu? Like, why is this the area that you thrive in the most?
Ooh, that's a great question. That's a great closing question. Thank you for getting me off of the rack on this one. I started off in gaming, like I feel like most people do, with D&D. And I had a great time throwing 20d6 fireballs at dragons. That shit is fun. That was great for that season of my life. But as I grew, as I evolved, as I matured, I started getting introduced to horror, Call of Cthulhu specifically, at a gaming convention here in Columbus called Origins. And Elliot, some pushed my wig back about horror. Like, I went from lobbing fireballs at dragons and saving the princess and doing really cool things with my tiefling to sitting at a table where a girl was unconscious in the hospital, had been in a coma for like 5 years, but she was pregnant. And all of our investigators were trying to figure out what happened. One, I was like, what? What the fuck are we doing? What? What? And I'm sitting through that experience and I'm watching two players, honest to God, cry at the table, like tears coming down their face. And I'm sitting here like, what the fuck is happening right now? Where am I? Do y'all see these people are actually crying? These people are physically crying at the table. This is a game. What is going on? And then 30 minutes later, the doctor and like the father of the girl that was in the hospital are now standing up on the side of the table, screaming at each other, actually screaming at each other. And I'm sitting here as like baby horror player going like, do y'all see these two people actually yelling at each other? Do y'all see this bullshit? Everyone is okay with this? Everyone is on board with the crying and the screaming? I got off of that table and was just like, I didn't know storytelling could do this. I've never cried during a D&D or a Pathfinder game. I can't tell you the last time I screamed at somebody because usually I don't have that type of emotional buy-in or that type of charge. And once I saw that that was a form of storytelling, that they were all LARPers, I didn't know that at the time. So they're real serious about their embodiment. I now identify as one of those two. I realized that the horror gaming community pretty consistently attracts a brand or a style of storytelling that I just really enjoy playing with. So that's how I got stuck into horror. And that's where I've been for the last few years in my gaming evolution. I love what it does to my nervous system. I love the sense of surrender. I love walking into a situation wondering how I can break, how beautifully I can break, and then what it looks like on the back end of the breakage. It's just what I enjoy in storytelling. So that's how I got stuck into horror. That's what I love in horror, and that's what I continue to do in horror.
Man, how beautifully I can break. That should be on a shirt.
Yes, babe.
Look how beautiful I break. Oh,
how beautifully can I break? Yeah.
I'm writing that down. That's a tagline for something.
Is that the episode title?
I know, right?
Honestly.
That's pretty good.
That's pretty good.
Bridget, I've got one last question for you. This is the question that we ask everybody who comes on the show.
Green is my favorite color. Oh, sorry. Sorry, you were going in a different direction. My bad. Go ahead.
This is usually a question I prep people for in advance, but I always forget.
At this point, usually is
Elliot
a lie.
Remembers.
The shade.
And this is just another chance for you to recommend something that you love. So the question is, what are you bringing to the table? So what is, who is a person? What is a game, a show, a resource, anything within the tabletop space or outside of the tabletop space that you would want to recommend to our audience because it's something that you're excited about?
Oh, okay. My mind fractured into 17 different places and I can't even pick the pieces off the ground fast enough. Okay, I'm going to go for the one that seems the loudest in front of me. A book called The Ruins, R-U-I-N-S by Scott Smith. It is by far today my favorite horror book of all times. I mean, it's delicious. To be honest with you, I might actually go back and read it again this year now that I'm looking at the cover and thinking about it. The premise is super simple, and this isn't a spoiler, but you've got your standard cliche, which do not be afraid to play in cliches when you're designing horror games. Cliches work. They're cliches for a reason. People kind of quickly identify with them and go, this is your standard. A bunch of college kids go somewhere down south and some terrible shit happens to them. Long story short, these Americans, I think they go to the Mayan ruins somewhere in Mexico and they get stuck on a mountain. And the antagonist in this particular situation is the wildlife around them. It's the plants. Bridget's favorite brand of horror today is plant horror. Give me some green horror and I will run all day long. I don't know what it is about plant horror, but it really tickles my fancy. Major, major inspiration points from this book that I will say, if you are developing stories, if you're looking at storytelling, if you're writing horror, blah, blah, blah. Several things. One, the characters are relatable. Yes, in horror, we all love our cannon fodder where the people just get murked super fast. But the horror hits harder if these are actual real people with goals and real relationships and real connective tissue with the people around them and the environment. One, these are real. These aren't your standard, like, just fuck them, kill them off college kids. They were actually people with, you know, real fleshed out characters. The next thing is the mob, the creatures in this book are so hilariously antagonistic, you're almost rooting for them because they're so fucking petty. And if you're looking at cosmic horror, if you're looking at Lovecraftian horror, that's the whole thing, right? There's entities and things beyond the abyss that don't give a fuck about you. You can't touch them. You can't hurt them. They are unbothered by you completely, and they're going to do whatever they want to do, and you can try to find a ritual or an item to stop them if you can get send thoughts and prayers. They don't care about you because you are so minuscule to them. These plants are so petty, it just makes for good storytelling because the way that they antagonize these characters physically is just body horror for days. The way they antagonize them psychologically, it's so deliciously petty. I usually try to implement that somewhere into my storytelling. I did it to you guys at the table. There were multiple times the Mythos did shit that was just like, wasn't really effective, but it was funny and it was petty. it was super petty. And the other thing this book does exceptionally well, at least when you're looking at what the antagonist is doing, is do not sleep on those subtle seeds that you can plant that will bother a player or bother the plot or bother the audience. You don't have to always hit them hard. Ha ha, right? Da-da-da, seeds. Those subtle seeds hit really hard. Me walking by and outing somebody's very intimate backstory and then walking away from them and acting like I didn't do it is a great way to have that person sit back and go, what the hell just happened? Am I alone in this moment? I'm alone. So y'all gonna act like I just didn't get outed for killing blah, blah, blah? Okay, that's fine. How does this person know? How did this... Those little subtle things can go a long way. You don't have to hit them with a jackhammer. You can go in with a scalpel and actually cause more pain.
Say the name of that book one more time.
Yeah, this is The Ruins, written by Scott Smith.
Hell yeah. And we will link that in the show notes.
Hey!
Well, Bridget Jeffries, thank you so much for coming to the table today. Do you want to let people know where they can find you on the internet?
Yeah, where are the quick places you guys can find me? If you are looking to run demos or official games for Chaosium, or you are looking to self-publish on one of our community content programs for Call of Cthulhu, RuneQuest, 7th C, or very soon Pendragon, feel free to email me at bridget@chaosium.com. That is bridge that you walk across with two T's at chaosium.com. If you are interested in anything to do with horror, and that's gaming, podcasting, streaming, publishing, hit me up at my gaming company that focuses on horror, which is Symphony Entertainment. And the easiest way to do that is just go to symphonyentertainment.com and you can get links to the Discord, the Patreon, the Instagram, the Twitter, the X, the Y, whatever the fuck it's calling itself today, Blue Sky, and blah, blah, blah. But feel free to connect, especially if you're an indie publisher and you've got a horror game that you're trying to get some additional eyes on. That is our warm and fuzzy place. Let us signal boost you. Let us play the game. Come onto my platform and run it so I don't have to. It's more organic when it's coming from you anyways. Definitely feel free to hit me up.
And if you want more gaming content from us, check out the 20-Sided Newsletter and the Many-Sided Media Discord. Those are both linked in our show notes. Please rate, review, and follow wherever you get your podcasts, because it really helps the show and it makes us feel all warm and fuzzy inside. Chinook, I can see you. I can see you about to do the outro line on me. I see you. Just do it.
No, you do it.
No, just do it.
I don't want to hear you do it.
I want to hear you do it.
We want you to do it.
Chinook, we want you to do it.
And that's what the table's talking about, folks. That's what we're doing.
Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Oh my gosh.
Can you tell that we spend a lot of time together, the three of us?
Oh goodness. But listen, you guys as a connective vibe is delicious. Oh.
You like us. You really like us. At least I assume that you do, as you've listened to every minute of this episode. And yet you haven't already left us a 5-star review? Ugh. Well, what are you waiting for? Get over to Spotify or Apple Podcasts and leave that review now. It's always wonderful to hear words from our adoring fans. Getting more ratings helps people find the show and love it as well. And we love to hear your nice words. So head over to Spotify and Apple Podcasts and leave us that 5-star review. Ta-ta!